chapter 11, verse 1. And it says that false weights is an abomination to God, and a perfect stone is his will. Mean an abomination to God. Basically, abomination means something disgusting. And we know God cannot, we cannot know anything about God, so what does it mean it's an abomination to God? It would apply to God's will, because we cannot know, God doesn't have a will as we understand it, and we cannot know anything positive about God. The only thing that we can know about God is what he is not. And so, therefore, the question is, what does it mean, abomination or disgusting to God or his will? Usually, when you have one of God's traits, you could understand that it's a certain action. In other words, something that occurs in the physical world. Like, for instance, vengeance, God's vengeance. He knows the punishment, God's anger, God's mercy. I mean, their person deserves something bad, but God overlooks it for some reason, for whatever reason. Or whatever qualities you're talking about, you could see that it could fit somehow into the physical world, so we don't have to attach it to God. But the term disgusting, that it's disgusting or an abomination to God, that is a quality. How could you interpret that in terms of the physical world? Most cases you could see, like vengeance, you could look at an act. You don't have to look at the personality. You could look at it as an act. God's hand, God's mercy. You could look at it as an act. So therefore it becomes easier to interpret in terms of the physical world. You see? But however, abomination is not an act, it's a quality, it's a certain feeling, right? So therefore the question is, how could you interpret it? And that's the difficulty of the interpretation, because the term itself, you can't put it in terms of an act. Hard to put in terms of an act. But approaching it by looking at the word abomination. What we do notice is that what we saw from the question, that there is no action. Right? In the word abomination itself, there is no action. Something that does not show up, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't show up. It's like an inner thing. It's something hidden. That you can't see how God acts here. I'm saying that when it's an abomination to God, the consequences or results that would show up in a hidden manner. In other words, in all other things, it's more open how it shows up. In other words, there's an open consequence, like God will throw us out of the land, or God will make things grow, even though, according to the laws of nature, it shouldn't grow. So you could see, in other words, it's a real physical, open thing. But the term abomination is something that is not seen. In other words, if we analyze it as a metaphor, one of the qualities of abomination is something that is not seen, and therefore the consequence is a little more quiet that you cannot see. Continue, I would like to also understand, what are false weights? Okay? False weights is where years ago they used to have a stone, let's say, worth a weight a pound. If I wanted to sell flowers and I want to sell a pound, so I'd put the pound on one side, and then I'd start pouring the flour until it evens out. Let's say, for instance, I'd scrape off a little bit of the stone, slightly. So therefore, to each person that I sell flour, I'd be selling a little less than a pound. Oh, and I do that to all my stones, half pound, 2 pounds, right? Now, this type of harm, this type of sneaky harm, is very, very hard to catch. And it frankly seems, it's a rare that you can't, I mean, it's hard to catch a person like that. And it seems almost as if a person like that would get away with getting caught. In In other words, there's certain type of sneaky acts that is practically impossible to get caught. It's very difficult.
It's so minute.
So if a person is a little bit careful, he could probably get away with it for long periods. Most of the times, other type of crimes, it's usually they will be found out. But there's certain type of crimes so sneaky that it's very easy to get away with. Okay? So the question is, we know that God created the laws of nature in such a way that there would be a high probability in the wicked person failing. Now the question is, where is the probability of this type of person failing? God's system is set up, and that's really the purpose of Proverbs, to show the consequences of all your actions. And also another question in this verse, the consequence is not mentioned. You see, the consequence is not mentioned. All it says is an abomination of God, and it doesn't mention the consequence, and the purpose of the book is to show the consequences of evil acts and the benefit of the acts of the righteous. What I'd like to say is that every act that a person does affects his soul. You see? Can't help that. Any act, if it's a good act, then it affects you in a beneficial way. If it's an incorrect act, then it harms you. In other words, one type of act is in line with truth and reality, and one type of act is you're acting not in line with truth, the opposite. You're operating based on your feelings, which is an irrational view of life, and that part of you becomes stronger. Okay? Now, if that is true, then at a certain point, as you see life irrationally, at a certain point, it will show up to destroy you. In other words, it is possible to do certain acts in such a way that you will not get caught. But what's happening along the line is your soul is training itself to look at life in an incorrect way, and that's developing. And as you look at life in an incorrect way, so your soul suddenly reaches a quality or a level, where suddenly you will start making decisions on more incorrect than before, and then it will show up. You see? In other words, it's a development. That's what an abomination to God means. It's an abomination means that God created inherently not only in your actions that there are consequences, but it affects you. And since it affects you, so then at a certain point, it's going to destroy you. Where does God fit into this? When you say an abomination of God, how does that fit in? How does that term and how does that expression fit into the idea of the consequences, what I'm talking about? The answer is that every time that we give a quality about God, what we're saying how God affects the physical world. Okay? Because we cannot know any qualities about God. That's one of the 13 basic principles of our faith, is that we cannot accept any quality about God. We cannot know anything about God himself. But we can know how God operates in the physical world. We can see the results. So whenever we see a term about God, we have to see how it fits into the physical world. Now, and that's why in all other terms, like we said before, most of them are action words, so I don't have to look at a quality. Abomination is a quality word. Where do you see an action? You feel disgusted. You usually feel. It's not an action. It shows up like maybe in your face, like you show a little disgust, you know what I mean? but there's no real action. The same thing here. Here it shows up. God shows up very, very... in other words, God created in the laws of nature that the consequence is a slow-type process. And that is every act that you do affects you. And therefore, if you do an act in such a way where it does not show up, okay, do not think that you have escaped consequences, because the act is affected, even though you might have gotten away with this particular act, but the act is affecting the way you look at life, the way you view life. And since it's affecting the way you view life, after a certain point, you'd view life in a more irrational, reaches higher levels of irrationality, and higher levels of looking at life incorrectly, so your decisions will be further away from reality, and then you will get the consequence. Right. And the instruction is to the soul. And of course, ritzono, his will, doing it God's will, a complete stone his will, means that you're getting in line with reality. And therefore, you're bettering your soul, and you're learning to live in line with truth and reality, so you get all the benefits that the physical world has to offer. God want us to be good? Does God want us to keep the commandments? Is that I cannot know anything about God, so the question is unanswerable. I can't answer the question because you have to know God. All I could say that it's within God's will, all I could see it is how it benefits me. How it helps me be in line with God. I cannot know who or what God is, but any term that the Torah uses about God, a quality of God, is something that if I understand, I will see how it works in the physical world. Now, when you say that it's God's will to do a certain thing, it means if I do it, if the human being does it, then that would be beneficial for him, perfect his soul, be beneficial for his soul, and bring him closer to God. But however, we cannot know anything about God. In other words, we have to sum up the verse. We would say there are that a person's personality is affected by his actions in one of two ways. Either it's affected by seeing truth and reality, or it's affected by living the life of the irrational life. Since you are affected and you start living it, and it reaches higher levels of that life. In other words, if you're living the rational life, then you'll have higher levels of the rational life. Every act of rationality will lead your soul to the whole personality to a higher level. And if you make irrational decisions, then it makes your personality such that you will see life and make decisions in an irrational manner. If I have to put it in terms of subject, the subject is that the human being is affected by his very soul or personality is affected by his actions. And there are two ways that it can be affected, either rationally or irrationally. The very soul is affected that way. We're up to verse 2. If an arrogant man comes to town, then what comes with him is disgrace. And to the modest person comes wisdom.
Okay.
What we have is that if the arrogant person comes and he causes disgrace, it should say that the modest person comes and causes wisdom to others. But that's not what it means. To the modest person, he receives wisdom. The modest person receives wisdom. He does not give wisdom, so what does one part have to do with the other? This is that what it's saying, that is when the arrogant person comes to town, he causes to most people increase. In other words, because he's an arrogant person, puts people down. So therefore, when he puts people down, it causes them to disgrace. But however, when he disgraces the tsnuim, the modest person, according to the Ibn Ezra, he says that they're ashamed to do arrogant acts. They're ashamed to do an act that would harm others or disgrace others. That the two sides of the verse that's equated is the receiver of the contempt from the arrogant person. Most people feel disgraced from the arrogant person, and the modest person gains wisdom. Now the question is, just because I don't show my disgrace, in other words, he's right. Is the question is that he doesn't have any, he doesn't feel disgrace. I mean, then he's on a very, very high level. I mean, a person that doesn't feel disgrace, he must feel disgrace, but he's modest. He doesn't show the disgrace. You see. In other words, if somebody puts him down, he feels the pain. You can't say he doesn't feel the pain. You see. In other words, that's what we say about a chacha, about a wise person. If the person was a prophet, then even if a person, put him down, he would not feel bad at all. We're not talking about such a person. There's no gain in wisdom on that level. In other words, if you're on the level of a prophet where you don't have the feeling of when somebody puts you down that you put down, you don't have that feeling, so then you're not going to gain knowledge. There's no more knowledge to gain anymore. He's there. It doesn't affect him. But however, the chacham, the wise person, that still he has emotions, he has feelings. He's a normal human being, and when somebody disgraces him, he's disgraced. So therefore, he might not show it. Modest means that he hides. Modest means that you hide things. So when he hides it, he's still going to feel the pain. Let me explain this again. If the person is a prophet, that is not what the verse is talking about. That's a different level of person. The book of Proverbs is talking to the beginner, not to the highest level of a human, where he dealt with all his emotions and he doesn't have the conflicts of a regular person. Okay? Proverbs is dealing with a regular person. So therefore, the thing is that it can't be that. So regular person, he's saying, he's modest. What is modest? Modest means that you cover up, right? So he covers up his feelings. Let's say, for instance, he wants to answer back. He's attacked by the person, right? By the arrogant person, and he wants to answer back. He won't answer back. He'll cover his feelings, and he just won't say anything. Now, that's fine. I understand the guy has self-control. In other words, the person has self-control. But, however, where, in what way, and where does he get his wisdom from? What is the wisdom that he's getting here? He has two ways of gaining wisdom here. One way of gaining wisdom, see, if a person only controls himself, then of course he's not going to gain any wisdom. He's just going to control himself. He's just going to feel the pain, and it'll happen again and again, and that's it. It's over with. But however, an intelligent person is going to do one of two things. One is he's going to try to work out the situation in such a way that it shouldn't occur to him. It shouldn't happen to him. In other words, either he's going to do something or stay away or set up a situation, which means he's going to make a plan or a strategy on how to operate. So he's training his mind how to deal in different situations with these people, because there's all different ways that the arrogant person is going to attack, you see? So he always has to work it out. So he's going to work it out through training practically. Right? The second thing is that when a modest person is affected, he feels a conflict, so then he thinks through the conflict and thinks through how to undo the conflict. Okay, he's not going to live in that state. So when the conflict comes about, he's going to think about the conflict and try and work it out. So therefore, he could get wisdom insofar as his own emotions are concerned, understand his emotions and how to deal with it, and how to reach the level of a prophet by undoing these emotions that cause him this conflict. First half is either where he brings contempt, the arrogant person brings contempt, where a person, or disgrace, is where a person either does not answer, but he doesn't think it through, so he's only disgraced. You see, that's the first half. Or he brings disgrace or contempt to another person, and the other person answers back. In other words, he's training himself in answering, so his reaction is not a healthy reaction because he's not dealing with it. While ever what we call a modest person, we mean a person that's a thinker, and therefore, insofar as a reaction, it'll be a plan thought out just how to protect himself, but it won't be a reaction. Be thought out and done in a just and correct manner. Or he will deal with his own emotions so that he wouldn't feel the conflict of the arrogant person. From the arrogant person, right. But I would say that we're measuring two ways of reacting to a degradation. There's two ways of reacting to degradation. In other words, in the first half, I react incorrectly, either by just accepting the degradation or by reacting to the degradation. Either way would be wrong. Or two, the other way is working it out through wisdom, either through strategy or through dealing with my emotions. I'd like to make one comment here, and that is we see from this verse that sometimes a person that receives an injustice, how he reacts to that injustice will also determine whether he's acting in a Torah manner or not. In other words, you can't say just because I'm reacting, it's his fault. He might be the cause, but how I react to him is also considered in Torah an act. So we have to see our reactions too. Many times we have the rationalization to say, oh, he started it. That might be true that we have that rationalization, but the fact is how you react will also be analyzed by Torah, but whether the way you reacted, that's a rational or irrational manner of operation. If there are two ways to react, not through wisdom, to the arrogant person. One is not to say anything, or one is to answer back. The question is, of the two, which is the better way? The first possibility is that there are two parts to the correct way of doing it. One is not answering, and two is to think through how to deal in this situation. So they're saying at least if you can't think it through, if you do the action, then at least you're doing half of the correct action, right? Alright, and the question to that is, but maybe the half is of no benefit. So maybe there is no difference. For the intelligent person, for the modest person, is that if he doesn't answer back, so he feels a certain conflict. Conflict causes you to investigate your emotions. In other words, it causes you an investigation. Since the situation is painful, so it causes you to either investigate your emotions or to investigate how to deal correctly in this situation. So it's the pain which causes the wisdom. But however, if you only have pain and there's no wisdom, then that's all you're getting is pain and nothing else. I would say, though, that the reason why, it is true, I think it is better for a person to control themselves than to react. Because when you react, it's like an act of vengeance. You're answering back, you're attacking back. Once you're doing that, you're aware simultaneously that you're only doing it for vengeance, like a reaction, but every action that a person does affects their very soul. So since it affects their soul, it will lift their level of vengeance to a higher level, it'll lift their aggression to a higher level, and then they could become the arrogant person that tries to destroy others, that tries to put others down. But if you control it, at least you're not going in a bad direction. You might have the anger, but since you don't carry out the act, you will not be going in a bad direction. While the other way, you're giving vent to the aggressive area of the personality, could have an outlet, it could have very bad consequences. But of course, that's only the best of the two. The best way is to work it out rationally. Verse 3 says that the perfection of the righteous will guide them, and the distortion of the traitor will destroy them. Of the traitors. The distortion of the traitors will destroy them. What is a traitor? What do you mean by the distortions, and how will it destroy them? And what is the perfection of the righteous, and how will it guide them? The question of traitor. The question is, what is a traitor? It is somebody that belongs to a group and then tries to harm the very group he or she belongs to. The question is, when King Solomon is speaking in Proverbs about a traitor, what group does he belong to that he's trying to harm? First, the reality. That's the subject of Proverbs. He belongs to Proverbs, and he's a traitor to the very idea of truth. In other words, he lives totally, he constantly makes decisions. All his decisions are constantly made based according to his own feelings and his own emotions, never a view of the truth, never a view of reality. That he's not trying to harm reality, but he's just trying to ignore it. The answer to that question is that he has to, a bogate, a traitor, in this sense, is a person that his whole emotional makeup is that to keep his own emotion safe, he has to constantly distort reality. Okay, let me try to give an illustration. A good illustration would be like Haman. Haman's personality, you see two things about Haman. One thing is that he gave advice to the king that the women should always be subservient. They shouldn't be able to stand up to their husbands. You see that he was always afraid that people, he was always afraid that a person might become independent or in their own right. He needed subservience. And that was to protect, you understand, that was to protect the fragile ego. So he had a weak ego, fragile ego, you see. You see the same thing when Mordechai wouldn't bow down to him. So he checked out Mordechai, he saw it was the whole philosophy, he became very frightened of that philosophy, of a group of people that would not bow down to him. So what he had to do was, he had to hide the reality that he has any weakness. And when Mordechai stood up to him, that was the reality breaking through his own emotions. So he had to spend his life distorting reality. That's what they mean by a traitor to reality. You understand? Let's say, for instance, if a person has a bad self-image, right? Now, they want to deny, they don't want to face the fact that they have this bad self-image. Well, let's say, for instance, a person has a part of his personality that he's ashamed of, and he wants to hide it from himself. So he keeps operating on, if you've read the autobiography of G. Gordon Liddy, he says that he was a mama's boy, and then he started doing crazy things to make himself tough. So you see that he constantly tried to cover up. His toughness was not a natural toughness, but it was the toughness of a person that's trying to cover up a weakness which he doesn't want to face. That person by a traitor to reality means his whole life he's totally trying to distort the reality. You can't accept reality. That's what it means. It's a traitor to reality. Perfection of the righteous. The perfection of the righteous means that his emotions are totally in line with his thoughts. When a person first starts to think, and he starts working out, think correctly with chachma and, you know, with wisdom, right? And he starts seeing the truth, his emotions are not in line with it. Now, a person can actually make decisions according to his mind, what is in reality, even though his emotions don't accept it. That's a righteous person, a tzaddik, on a lower level. However, the highest level is where, as he keeps studying, his emotions come in line with these ideas. You see? That is perfection. Perfection means where there is no conflict between your emotions and your thoughts. The beginner, wise person, there is a conflict, even though he sees the truth and lives the truth, but there's a conflict. His emotions wanted to go back the other way. Basic definitions of a traitor and a perfection. Now we have to see how the perfection, where the emotions are in line, guides him, and how the distortion destroys the traitor. Whereas the question is like this. Let's say, for instance, a righteous person that lives according to logic. Now, definitely, he won't get the consequences. Now we're saying that the perfection, meaning the total person where his emotions are in line with logic, will guide him. That's a different type of thing. In other words, it has to be logic, but you have to somehow show how his emotions are also, that's in line with reality. And you have to see in the traitor that it's not only the decisions, but the distortion of the whole personality. You see? That's what we want. In the book of Proverbs, up until now, what we've seen how if you're irrational, so you have certain consequences, and if you're rational, then you won't get those consequences, right? Now we're talking about the perfection of the righteous, which means the total being somehow helps him also, the question would be, really only rationale and thought and wisdom will guide you. How does the emotions that in line with the reality, how is that going to guide you? That's not the guide. That's a result. The same thing, it's the decision of the traitor that's going to destroy him. Not the distortion is only the cause of his decision. But here he's saying the distortion itself will destroy him. There are two people that live in line with reality. One, his emotions are in line with reality, and one, the person is in conflict. Right? Now we're saying somehow that the person that is in line with a reality, his emotions will guide him so that he will not ever have any consequences, while the other person will. So the question is, How does that work? Since they're both living logically, how is it possible? And wherein lies it better, practically, where your emotions are in line with reality? Definitely, the person that's in line with reality, definitely doesn't have the conflict of the person that's not in line with reality, but he's making decisions on reality. He doesn't have the conflict, that's for sure. But the only thing is, the verses say that it will guide him, meaning that there'll be no consequences because of this. What we'd like to know is the difference between the two. Is that you see, the emotions are very, very subtle. And the person that's guided by wisdom will not make open mistakes because he's guided by wisdom. But however, since his emotions are not in line, where there is a subtle difference, then the emotions will make him see the incorrect one. It will set him, in other words, I'll give you an illustration. When Jacob was raising Joseph, Joseph had the qualities, leadership qualities. Therefore, he should have been raised differently than the brothers, and that would have been a rational thing to do. But once it was a rational thing to do, there was also an emotion there, that because he loved, there was an emotional attachment to Joseph more than the other brothers. So because of that attachment, the quantity of what he did for him went too much and caused them to give him the coat of many colors, which brought out, in other words, that's only symbolic of the, that his ego was brought out because he sensed from his father that love, and it also brought out the sibling rivalry of his brothers. So what you do see is that where the emotions are there, it could affect you. But if you don't have the emotions, so then it pushes you towards the right way. It pushes you towards the objective view of reality. It would protect him from the consequences. And you see, by Jacob, he paid the consequences. And Joseph. And the traitor to truth, there are two things. There is one, that a person lacks knowledge of how to operate in the physical world. Sometimes a person, the difference between acting correctly, incorrectly, is if he had knowledge. Let's say a person studied, he would see truth and see how to make decisions in life, so then he would actually, because of his knowledge, he would make correct decisions. But if a person is ignorant, so he simply makes decisions based on that ignorance because he never learned the truth. He never learned a method of analyzing how to make decisions, how to make plans and strategy in the physical world, how to deal with the physical world. But what we're saying now is that's one thing, that's ignorance. What we're saying by the Bogey, there's a powerful emotion to hide reality. It's the emotion itself that even if he was trying to be taught the truth, he would not be able to accept it. That's what it means. The distortion of the traitor will destroy him. In other words, it will not even allow him to find the truth. In other words, sometimes what you're lacking is just the truth. So we have to teach you the truth. But by the bogey, by the traitor is a person that's against reality. He's trying to distort reality. He's afraid of reality breaking in. And to show him what he really is, he doesn't want to see what he really is. So therefore, because of that, that emotion will destroy him, because it will not allow him to see reality when reality breaks in.
Put it this way.
Let's sum it up this way. There are three types of people that they cannot find the truth. One person is, he never studied reality, he never studied the truth, he never got the chance. So therefore, he simply is going to make decisions based on his emotions. Another person, even if he was given the truth, he couldn't accept it because his emotions will not allow him to accept the truth. A third person found truth and lived a life of truth, but every once in a while, because of a deep-seated emotion, the deep-seated emotion will affect his thinking process, and therefore he'll make a mistake in the truth. And of course, those are three levels in not living the truth. Of course, the highest level is where you've undone all these emotions, so then your emotions are in line with reality, so therefore there will be nothing that will stop you from thinking incorrectly, so you'll always make correct decisions. But the pasuk is only talking about, you have to define the pasuk, it's only talking about two of these. One is where a person's emotions force them to go against reality, and the other side is that the person's emotions guides him into reality and forces him to stick in line with reality. Verse 4 says that wealth will not help on a day of destruction, and charity will save you from death. Your treasures will not help you on a day of destruction. What is a day of destruction? Usually it means a catastrophe that happens by virtue of the laws of nature. It's not in your hands. Okay? We'll have to see as we discuss it. Well, let's say, for instance, your house is ruined by a tornado. So if you're wealthy, it will help. You can rebuild your house. If you don't have money or you just have enough, then you can't rebuild. You'll really suffer. So it seems like it is a certain situations where it does help, the money, right? And if you give away your money to charity, in those cases, it will harm you, because you won't have the money to rebuild. How does it work that charity saves you from death? Right, we're up to verse 5, and it says, the righteousness of the perfected will guide his way, and in his wickedness the wicked will fall or fail. Ibn Ezra, medieval commentator, Terry says that that what does it mean, guide his way? It will make, in other words, his righteousness will make sure that he does not fail. Why does he translate it that way? I mean, simple, the way you should translate it is that he should be guided in his way. In other words, he should be successful in positive things, not that he shouldn't. Not should it be that he just won't fail. But it should be more than that. So he says, my proof is that because in the second half it says the wicked will fail, so the contrast must be that the righteous will not fail. Okay? So the question isn't success and failure a contrast? In other words, why does he have to say, one person will fail and one person won't fail? Maybe you should make a distinction between success and failure. The question is the words of guide, the word guide his way seems to mean a positive thing. But the thing is, so the question is, where does the Ibn Ezra get his interpretation that it means that he will not fail? Okay? So the thing is that when it says that he will guide his way, the righteousness of the perfected will guide his way, it will guide him that he will not have failures, that he will not fail. Another question that we have to ask, what is the difference between success and not failing? And another question is, what does it mean that the righteousness of the perfected will guide him? What does it mean by the righteousness? I can understand if he does correct actions, but he says the righteousness of the perfected one. You say, what does it mean, the righteousness? What does that mean? I'd like to go over the three questions that we have to go over it to have it clear in our minds. The first question is, why does he contrast Why does the Ibn Ezra contrast failure and non-failure? Why doesn't he contrast failure with success? Second question. What is the difference between success and non-failure? And the third question is, what does it mean, the righteousness of the perfected person? What does that mean? I mean, he does righteous actions. What do you mean, the righteousness? Like, there's a quality righteousness in the perfected person. What does that mean? The answer to the last question is like this. The question is, what is the difference between a tzaddik and a rasha, a righteous person and a wicked person? Okay? The wicked person, since he's self-centered, so he tries to change reality to fit into his perspective of the physical world. And if it doesn't fit in, so he twists and turns until it works out. The tzaddik is constantly trying to get the physical world, to get his emotions and his incorrect view of life in line with reality. Okay? There are two types of systems. There's like physics, the physical world, and then, in other words, your relationship to the physical world, and then your relationship to people. Okay? Now, most people could accept their relationship to the physical world, and they could recognize that they have to give in to the physical world, even though they might not want to, but they recognize. And they recognize there is some type of a system, like if you get sick, you have to go to a doctor, you have to watch if you're crossing the street. There's different things which they recognize that it is, that they're willing to accept. But however, nobody wants to accept that in the relationship with others, there it's more difficult to accept reality, okay? Because there our emotions is much stronger against accepting that reality. So the thing is, the ultimate reality and the most difficult reality is really to accept that you're part of a system of human beings, which is a system of justice and also a system of kindness, which is really a large part of the Torah that deals with that, which deals with the idea of how to relate to others in a system of justice. Because that is much more difficult to deal with. What I'm saying is that there, you must relate to two systems. One is the laws of nature, and two is people. Okay? And what we want to say is that it is more difficult to relate to people in a system, and you don't want to accept being bound by people and by system of justice. Person is more willing to accept to be bound by the laws of nature than he is by a system of justice that people are binding him, that he is less willing to accept. It's easier to accept the idea that I have a cold and that I have to go to a doctor and that I'm restricted from doing things than by being restricted that I'm not permitted to gossip or that I can't steal. Well, most people can understand stealing, but playing politics with other people, all different types of ideas and system of justice that I have to be kind to people. You see, all these things, that type of restriction is your person doesn't want to recognize that he's restricted by people. In other words, it's harder. Nobody wants to be restricted. They want to feel they're totally free. But I'm just saying it's harder to be restricted by other people than to be restricted by the laws of nature.
And also we see
that people accept dealing with the physical world as a reality. They're sick, they go to a doctor. But they can't accept justice and the relationship with others as an objective system. Like, for instance, gossip. You can't, what do you mean there's an objective thing I can't talk about people? Why can't I talk about people? You understand? I mean, so to say, you know what I mean? If I don't want to, I'm a nice person, but they don't look at it as it, that there is a system that people must relate to others, and that the only way this world can operate, and also that it's part of God's laws, that people don't want to accept as that they're restricted by other people. See, they look at it as not as being restricted by people. That they can't take. Well, the highest level of reality is when a person can accept that he is simply part of a system. He's part of the system, and he has to relate within the framework of justice and kindness, which the Torah talks about. He must relate to people within that framework, and he's not better than anybody else, but he is part and a parcel of that system, and not above that system. Is when it says the righteousness of the perfected guides him on his way, the question is, how does it guide him? What is this guide that he has that other people don't have? That he, only the Tamim, the perfected person, only he has this guide. What guide does he have? The answer is when we say a person is perfected, we mean that he has no conflicts. In other words, he accepts reality, his emotions accept that he must deal when he relates to the physical world, he must deal with the system. That he's only part of a system. He must relate to that system. Now, if his emotions accept that, so every time he's in a problem, every time he gets into a problem he has to deal, his emotions immediately guide him towards the solution via thinking about the system. He must think in terms of the system, how the system works. Whatever system he's dealing in, he could be dealing in halacha, he could be dealing in politics, he could be dealing in justice and kindness. All these are systems of relating to people. Now, since his emotions recognize that he must live within a system, so immediately his mind goes in line with those ideas. Okay? But the wicked is training himself to live in line with his emotions, right? And is it that he is always right, and anything that goes against him, he's going to turn and twist around to fit into his emotions, you see? So therefore, he's getting further and further from reality. He's training his emotions to go further from reality. So therefore, that's what it means, that his wickedness will cause the wicked to fall, meaning that he's going further from reality. It's in the Talmud where a person, something was stolen, and the rabbi was in the school where the students were, and he saw one of the students washed his hands. He had to dry his hands, and he dried his hands in somebody else's garment, somebody else's coat. So he says, that's the crook. Now, why is that? Because the thing is that wiping your hands means I don't have regard for your property. That's only one step in not having regard. The next not regard is stealing. There are different levels of not having regard for your property. Then after a while, it can lead to murder, because it's just like I don't have respect for your property. After a while, I don't have respect for you. So you keep going further and further away from reality, as you develop in your wickedness. And as you develop in righteousness, what you're learning to work out is every time there's a problem to look for the system of how to deal with that system. Therefore the system there. And once your emotions are in line with that, so that quality, every time you're in a trouble, you look for the system. While the wicked person, every time he's in trouble, he looks how to protect himself simply via his emotions and to disregard the other person altogether. We one time said that opposites always have a subject, okay? If we say failure and non-failure are opposites, and I would ask you what the subject is, that's one question. Then there are opposites of failure and success. Now, since that's different opposites, it should have a different subject. What is the difference in the subjects between these two sets of opposites? Somebody asked first, what's the difference between success and non-failure? Non-failure means, like, if I go to the doctor and I don't get sick because he gave me some medicine, so I prevented myself from failing. That was a non-failure. Okay? While, however, if I make $1 million, that we look at as successful. So it's more positive, or I become a doctor. That becomes, right, who gave me the medicine, that's a success.
When you have a success and failure,
the subject is reaching certain goals that you have for yourself. In other words, you set up a goal, and if you reach it, you're successful. If you don't reach it, you failed. You didn't reach your goal. So that failure means I didn't reach my goal. When you're talking about failure and non-failure, then you're talking about the two opposites in the practical world. Practically, I didn't fail. I have enough. I've done everything in the physical world so that I shouldn't be hurt, that I shouldn't be harmed. The practicality in this world is simply to avoid, let's say you go out to work. Why do you need money? So sometimes you look at it as a positive thing. Boy, I'll become a wealthy man, so it's a positive thing. Or you could look at money as just a practical thing, so I shouldn't starve and that I should have, I should satisfy my needs, whatever needs I have. I have a need for a comfortable chair. In other words, there are different needs that a person has, so if I don't satisfy those needs, practical needs I'm talking about, so then you failed. You see, that's a failure. Or I set up a goal that I should get someplace, I should make $1 million, then failure means I didn't succeed in my goal. But however, if you're talking about failure, not failure, then you're talking about simply practical, that there's certain things that I have to do to make sure I don't fail. So therefore, it's a practical thing to deal in the practical. Success and failure, the subject is goals. Well, you set up certain goals. Either you make the goal, that's called success. Well, you don't make the goal, that's failure. While the subject where you're talking about failure and non-failure is there certain things in the practical world that you must have or you must do, and if you don't, you're going to fail. So non-failure means that you didn't harm yourself. So it's a practical thing. Yeah, you're right. Practicality means just preventing any harm from occurring to you. To prevent any harm from occurring to you. That's all practicality is. I'm not saying there is no success. There is a positive thing. Let's say you want to go out and enjoy yourself. Right? I mean, you buy a car. You don't need it practically. Let's say you don't have. Let's say you have a goal to get a car. Right? It's a positive thing. Okay? So therefore, you have a goal to get it. If you need a car for business, then you'll lose out on business. That's practical. So that's a question of the car being failure. Yeah, that's right. So if you have the car, it's not failure. But let's say you want a car because you like, you're looking for a car, a special type of car, so then that's a goal. You might enjoy it, fine. It might be something you enjoy. But if you don't have it, so you just didn't reach your goal, that's what failure means in that case, that you didn't reach your goal. Ezra says that the proof that when we talk about the righteous by the perfected person, that we're talking about non-failure, because he says the second half of the verse is talking about the wicked, that he will be destroyed. So the opposite of being destroyed is protecting myself from being destroyed. He says, because if he was just not going to be successful, if that's what it was talking about, then he would say, then the positive of the verse would be that you're being successful.
Right.
You understand?
No.
Okay, once again. If the wicked, see, the wicked, it says that in his wickedness, the wicked will fail. Means he's going to be destroyed. Now, what's the opposite of being destroyed? Not being destroyed, not failure, because the thing is, why? Because that's a practical thing, that you should protect yourself from being failed. But if it was talking about the wicked, that he won't reach his goals, then the opposite would be that the righteous will reach their goals. Then it would be success. But he says, because of the second half of the verse, which is talking about the destruction of the wicked, so the tzaddik is just a non-failure. I mean, he won't be destroyed. But if he's talking about that the wicked, if the verse was talking about the wicked, that they weren't successful in their goals, then we would have the positive on this side. So how could you tell the difference, since the in both categories, the opposite is both failure? So we're saying that there's two types of failure. There's a failure that's taking away. You don't have what to eat. Practically, you're being destroyed. Or, practically, I'm not fulfilling my goals. We see the opposite. We see this type of opposites in chapter 10, verse 28 of Proverbs, that says that the hope of the righteous is gladness, but the expectation of the wicked shall perish. Meaning, according to Rashi says that the hope of the righteous, the end they will be fulfilled, meaning they'll get their goal. Their goal, whatever they want, they will be successful. But the wicked, their goals won't come, so they'll fail. So we see the verses setting up these two types of opposites. Exactly what we said. Okay, that there are two types of... There's the subject of goals, and there you have success and failure, and failure means you don't reach your goal. That's verse 28 of chapter 10. And then there's destruction and the avoidance of destruction, which is non-failure, and that distinction we have in chapter 11, verse 5. The question is, what is there about the quality of righteousness that will make you successful, or that you won't fail, either way, and what is there about wickedness that will make him fail, either way, okay, whether, you know, fail or that he won't be successful? What is the quality there? Why is it? We said was at the beginning of this verse, we said that righteousness is working in line with a system. So when you train your mind to be in line with the system, then naturally, when something goes wrong, you think in terms of that system. So you're guided to always search for an answer via that system. That's if your nature is guided by righteousness. But if your nature is guided by wickedness, which means that I am above the system, and what I have to do is simply satisfy my needs, okay? That is what I want to do, and when I search for answers, it's only via my needs, so then I won't be in line with reality, and therefore, by definition, I have to fail. We're going to translate verse 7 according to the Ibn Ezra, okay? And he says, with the death of a wicked man, his hope is lost, and with his hope for power will also be lost. Okay? Now, when he says the first half of the verse, the hope of a wicked man, he says the hope of what it means, the hope of a wicked man, it means it means his desire to oppress others. Okay? So the two halves of the verse is that with the death of a wicked man, his hope to oppress others is gone, and his hope for power is lost. Question is, what is he dealing with? What's happening here? What is he dealing with? What is the subject? Yes. Is that usually the Ibn Ezra puts a tzaddik, the contrast between a wicked person and a righteous person. And so the question is, why doesn't he make that contrast here? According to the Ibn Ezra, I think, well, and we'll soon see as we work on it, what I think you were going to find that he's making a contrast between two different qualities in the wicked person. Ibn Ezra, I think this verse is not dealing with a righteous person at all. What is the difference between the search for power and the desire to put people down? It seems to come from the same quality. You see? Question, it's true after he dies, it might not continue, but however, it will happen during his lifetime, we're saying. It's only after he dies it will not continue, but it will happen after his lifetime. Question is, why would it stop after his death? Say that, how could he hope for anything after he's dead? You're right. I mean, it's a funny type of verse. In other words, you could tell me he has hopes and he satisfies his hopes during his lifetime. Is that correct? Fine. And after you're dead, you know, you're not going to satisfy. So of course it's not going to be satisfied. What new are you telling me? What are you telling me? That last question, you have to take one step. You must say that this verse is talking to the emotion of the fantasy of immortality. That a person feels that he's going to live forever. And somehow he holds the desire to destroy others and the desire for power is somehow a part and parcel of the fantasy of immortality. Question is how? Is what he's trying to do, he's saying that what the basic motive for these two emotions is that will give you immortality. And therefore the only way to undo this immortality, the only way to, and therefore he's trying to tell you, the verse is trying to say, you should see reality and don't let that emotion of the fantasy of immortality to take over your life. But our question is, where does the Ibn Ezra see that in the emotions where the hope one emotion is the desire to harm others, and the others is for his own power. I mean, it seems to be these two emotions are the same, like we asked before. And two, where does he see in these two emotions the fantasy of immortality? The question is, why do I say that the verse is talking about the fantasy of immortality? Okay? And the answer is, of course, with the death of a wicked person, his hopes are lost. Now, I don't need King Solomon to tell me that after a person dies, his hopes are lost. We already know that. So, therefore, it's talking about that somehow he imagines that his hopes will last afterwards. In his, someplace in his emotions, he feels that somehow he's going to last afterwards. And King Solomon is telling him that it will not last afterwards. In other words, King Solomon feels that he has to tell him this, which means it must be talking about an emotion, like an unconscious emotion that he's not aware of. Because if he's not psychotic, so then he'll look at the facts and say, look, if I die, of course my hopes are going to die. Okay, every human being is that way, you see? Now the question, but he seems to be faking himself out. Okay? Now, and the King Solomon has to tell him that you're faking yourself out. So King Solomon, according to the Ibn Ezra, is talking to that emotion.
I don't have the answer, but I would like to take another step.
That, say, according to the Ibn Ezra, see, a person that has the fantasy of immortality can't be facing reality. He has to hide reality. Okay? He has to cover up reality. Okay? Or somehow he has to prove in his own mind that he's going to live forever. Somehow the Ibn Ezra holds that power, or the putting down of people, or subjugating people, somehow covers up the reality that I'm not going to live forever. Somehow that must be a means of hiding and covering up the reality, so that I could still believe that I will live forever if I gain power or I subjugate others. The question is how do these two activities cause me to feel that that reality is actually proving that I will live forever? That we don't know yet. The question is that I seem to be working backwards, and that I seem to accept the Ibn Ezra and then working back that way. Usually we work the other way. We just take the idea and start fresh. The reason is because I don't have the answer, and I'm just accepting the premise of the Ibn Ezra, and that is true. And I'm getting steps working backwards from his facts, and then later when we see his approach, how he approaches it, then we'll actually see the validity of this idea, whether we accept it or not. But right now, we're just trying to understand the Ibn Ezra. According to the Ibn Ezra says his hopes is to subjugate poor people. Okay? Now, the question is, why poor people over anybody else? You see? To understand what the Ibn Ezra is saying, we have to realize that there is a part of us that we are not aware of, okay? And in this part of us that we're not aware of, there is the fantasy of immortality that probably everybody has. It's a certain fantasy that they're going to live forever and they're not going to die. Now, but however, reality keeps intruding and keeps forcing them to face their mortality. And so what people try to do is they try to somehow prove or deny, prove their immortality or deny their mortality. That's what the Ibn Ezra is saying. The Ibn Ezra is saying there's two ways of holding on, denying reality. There's two ways of denying reality to hold on to your fantasy of immortality. One way is to prove your immortality, and one way is to deny your mortality. Okay? Now, the thing is the first thing is what is power? Power means that I have control over the physical world, right? It's via people. Some scientists feel it when they create certain things to control. Doctors feel it that they save lives. So this feeling of power is attached to the fantasy of immortality. It's a proof. See, I could control reality. I could control the physical world. I could change around the physical world. I could force people to do things. As in medicine, I could save people's lives, which constantly proves to me that I am more powerful than the physical, I am beyond the physical, and therefore I'll live forever. That's what the Ibn Ezra is saying power is. Now, what happens is, on the other hand, we see people with certain weaknesses. And since we're human, so we feel a certain identification with these people, and that weakness shows me that I'm mortal. So I have to constantly deny my identification with people that has that have weaknesses. Poor person is one type. Older people, cripples, people that are sick. You understand? All these types of weaknesses, I try to, anything that I sense is a weakness, and therefore if I identify with these people, it makes me recognize my mortality, so therefore I have to destroy them and say, see, I don't identify with them, I have nothing to do with them, I'm not mortal. So therefore, on the first half, the power is to constantly prove my immortality because I have control over the physical. The second part is my identification with people that have weaknesses and force me to realize my mortality, so I have to constantly do acts to break that relationship with people that are mortal. So therefore, it shouldn't break down my fantasy of immortality. That is what the Ibn Ezra is saying. He did say poor people, but I think he means that's only as an illustration, but it means any type of person with a weakness. Certain people are mean to old people because of that, to sick people, cripples, all different types. And so therefore, that any type that they sense that their fantasy of immortality is breaking down by identification, so they'll do anything to break that identification. What I'd like to do is clarify methodology on this past verse. And that is that many times when we have a verse, we just analyze the idea and try to understand the idea. In this past point, we didn't know what the Ibn Ezra was getting at, so what we started doing is just trying to define what he is saying. Whether I agree with him or not had nothing to do with it. You understand? It had to do with that he is a wise person, and therefore he would not say something foolish. He must have something in mind. So therefore, the steps were, we started taking his steps and to see, just taking steps from his statement to see where it would lead, even though we didn't know how it fit into the world of reality. Most of the time when we study Proverbs, many times we see what they're talking about. It's just a matter of working it out. We agree with it. It's a matter of working it out. Here we didn't see where we were getting at, so the approach, what he was getting at, we didn't know, realize what he was getting at, so the approach had to be, the approach in the study, in the analysis, had to be slightly different by just trying to abstract from him what he holds. Okay, until finally we saw what he's getting at, and then it made a lot of sense. We're doing verse 8. It says that a righteous person escapes from troubles, and a wicked person comes and takes his place. Now the question is that I understand that a wicked person has certain consequences for his actions and the way he operates, but however, to take the place of the righteous, and in his place he takes the troubles of the righteous, I don't see how that works. All the commentaries say that this pasuk, this verse, is dealing with God's personal relationship. In other words, we really live in two worlds. We live in the world of cause and effect, and we live in the world of good and evil. And therefore, both systems work. Okay? When we talk about God's providence or God's personal intervention in human affairs, he intervenes only based on good and evil. Okay? But however, we do live in a world of cause and effect. If I do something incorrect, it might not be evil, but if it's incorrect, if I go swimming and there happens to be an undertow, I'll die. And that's it, I'll be pulled down. So the thing is that I might have been ignorant. I didn't know there was an undertow. Maybe there was no way of knowing. It makes no difference. The fact is that it's based on cause and effect. It has nothing to do whether you're just or unjust. But however, God's personal providence relates to us via the human beings, justice and righteousness. Now what the verse is saying here, that in God's system, if according to the laws of nature, a righteous person would get into some trouble according to the laws of nature, according to cause and effect. And there was nothing he could do about it, but he deserves to be protected because of God's system, because of good and evil. So God saves him from that situation. But however, when God saves him from that situation, according to the system, then somebody must take the place of the tzaddik. This is according to the Meiri. And according to the verse, it makes sense. I mean, that's what the verse is saying. They must take the place of the righteous person, and he will get that very trouble that the righteous person should have gotten according to the laws of nature and gone intervene, and God places a wicked person in his place, and he gets the consequences what the righteous person should have gotten. Now the question is, I understand sometimes God's personal intervention is there to protect the righteous, but why is there a necessity to place somebody in that situation? Today man has made certain decisions about ecology. For instance, they took certain goats from one of the mountains around here. I don't remember if it was... They were mountain goats on one set of mountains. They weren't on the other. They figured it'd be nice. Take it to the other. Meanwhile, it's messing up the whole ecology there. You got to be careful what you, you know, different things you think you can move around, you know, like, you know what I mean? And you don't realize that when you touch, like, for instance, they say, every time you take medicine, practically all medicines have some side effect. Well, you can't fool around with nature. You know what I mean? I mean, you have to take the medicine if you really have to. So you have to take it because you have to protect your life. But you have to know that there is a certain system to nature, and it's working perfectly. Now, if you mess up that system, you better compensate. If you don't, you're going to be a mess. You see? Now, the human being, what the human being does is he gets involved in all these ecological decisions and all these decisions about when to operate, when not to operate on a human being. I mean, sometimes it's wild decisions. I mean, if it's a matter of life and death, you have no choice. Or even if it's a matter of the future, you know, real disease, you have to know when and where. So you have to do it. But the thing is, just to do it, you have to know you're messing with nature, and there's going to be consequences either in the human being or in the ecology and all these things. You see? Now, so therefore, in the system, what the verse is saying, that according to the system, according to the laws of nature, a person was supposed to die. Something was supposed to happen. Now, if it doesn't happen, then the ecological system is being messed up. I don't mean the ecological in the sense only the ecological, but there is a system operating here. You understand? There's a system. And according to the laws of nature, the system works in a certain way. You see? Now, if God intervenes, so now it is a break in the system. Now, that could set off a chain of events that can mess up the system down the line. You see? Somehow. So therefore, what God is saying, that I will compensate by placing a Russia, even though I would have never intervened to kill this Russia or to harm this Russia or to cause troubles, but since he is a wicked person, and there is a situation that I have to protect the system, so he's the one that I'll use at that time to put the system back into balance. It's understanding. Maybe I better clarify. Okay? The thing is when God protects the righteous person, so when he intervenes, by definition, something is changing in the laws of nature. He's suspending the laws of nature. It's not working perfectly. Now, what we do is we see from ecology, I'm not saying that it's an ecological system, but I'm just showing you from ecology, from medicine, that once you start touching the system, there are side effects that are harmful. So God says it's only just, it's true, it's just for the righteous person to protect him, but that's unfair to the rest of society, that there should be a break in the system, in the laws of nature. Now, so therefore, what God says, I have the right for a wicked person that I might have not bothered with, But since he happens to be there, I'll put him in his place to make sure that the system doesn't go haywire. So therefore, it's the wicked person is placed in the place of the righteous to protect the system.
The question is, what is the subject of the verse? Right? The answer is that it is providence, God's providence on the world. And there is two types. There are two types of providence. One providence is related to people, which is based on good and evil, depending on them. They are good or evil when God comes out to do certain things for or against them. Okay? Then there's another providence on the laws of nature, where God makes sure that the laws of nature are working. And if something is not working correctly, so then he corrects it. Now, the thing is, we only see from this verse that God corrects it when he himself interferes with the laws of nature to benefit the righteous. You see? Right? To benefit the righteous, he interferes with the laws of nature, then he corrects it. It would be interesting to see a proof if we could see that if man himself, especially nowadays where man has the ability to interfere with a lot of the workings of the laws of nature, it would be interesting to see a proof that God also intervenes in that situation also at some point to correct the laws of nature in that type of situation. Why is it, if that is that God needs to correct the system, the question is, why does he have to use only the Russia if he has to correct the system? The answer is that where a person has reached a level where his value in life is such that it's no benefit, so even though God might not go out to destroy him, but in that situation, then God could use him for the benefit of the universe. Why he doesn't do this to anybody else is because there's a chance, even though they're not living the good life, there's a chance of repenting. But the Russia that he's talking about here is a person where he reached a level where he can't, where he's not going to repent anymore, or he can't repent. So in that situation, God can use him to benefit the universe, however he needs him.